Just behave yourselves and act like men.
Now you start using your head. That's not love. That's 3 feet above your ass.
People will come, Ray.
All right, don't try to strike everybody out. Strikeouts are boring. Besides that, they're fascist.
We don't stink right now.
You play ball like a girl!
You're out of here!
There's no crying in baseball!
High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
This is West Coast Bias.
Dynamite drop in, Monty. That broadcast school has really paid off.
Some may say the winter holidays are the most wonderful time of the year, but they are wrong, and I defy them.
Yes, no, this is the greatest holiday of the year. Happy New Year. Happy opening day. And this is not a drill. This is not an April Fool's joke. We are back, West Coast Bias Baseball Podcast. We are healthy. We are alive. We are fully vaccinated and hope you are too.
It is true. Now, we're going to get a disclaimer now in our notes. Don't trust everything we hear. And you shouldn't. And I'm not even convinced that it's not an April Fool's joke because, who knows? Who knows how this show's going to go? It's been a while. We're a bit rusty.
We are. I am Samuel Paul.
I am Adam Nelson.
And I will have to admit to you all, like, right now, the past 4 months, almost 5 months, I really didn't think about baseball at all. I would, pass by, certain articles.
How do you sleep at night?
Not very well on occasion.
Now, that might have something to do with the shirt that I'm wearing right now, which
it might
is blue.
It might, and it reminds me of a particular event that I guess happened very late October 2020. But that just confirms what kind of strange messed up year 2020 really was.
No, it was but it ended well, and Pantone 294 came out on top. And it was the longest postseason of all time. It was arguably the hardest October in baseball history, and the cream rose to the top. Now, we already kind of went over that on our last episode, but now we're looking forward.
We are for sure. And, it got me thinking that before I even saw your shirt about, around this time, I guess it's now would probably be, 8 years ago. It was about a week before opening day of 2013 season. So yeah, I guess that was 8 years ago. And I was having discussion with a Phillies fan about how excited I was that it was opening day and baseball was going to be back. And being a Phillies fan, he was kind of down on life and said, yeah, well, it's much easier to be excited for the coming baseball season coming off a World Series win. And I sort of looked at him and said, but I thought you were a baseball fan. I mean, I look forward to every opening day because it really is hope springs eternal.
Right.
Everyone has a shot. Everyone starts at 0-0, and while some teams are expected to do a lot better than other teams,
still got to play the game.
You still got to play the game, and it's a fun game, and I absolutely love it, and I look forward to it, whether or not the Giants are projected to win 100 games or lose 100 games. And fortunately, it's very rare that either of those two things happen, but they do happen. And I love the game no matter what, because it is a game that is designed to break your heart. And every once in a while, as you found out, it doesn't. And it's really wonderful. And Yeah, so it don't matter what happens the rest of the season, this is a great day and something to always look forward to.
It's weird. All I don't right. have an applause. I appreciate that. I appreciate the eternal optimism because, yeah, indeed, everything you said is 100% correct. It's not just a day for the previous winners. It's a day for baseball fans the world over. Crack a beer. There you go. Right on cue. And we're rolling. And I believe Miggy. And now when you're listening to this, I'm sure all the games will be over and you'll be in a post-opening day revelry. And you have us to come down with. But Miggy got the season started off with a bang. Did he get the first hit or the first home run? I know he got the first home run.
I think he got the first home run. I don't think it was the first hit of the season, but it was definitely the first home run through driving snow, apparently, in Detroit.
The only way to do it.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess it's still pretty cold in parts of the country. You'd never know it here in the great city by the bay.
We always choose seemingly the warmest day of the year to do this show, and today is no different. Today in San Francisco, it's probably a nice high 70s, early yes. 80s. We are in a new studio as well, so if you hear different sounds of the city, it's because we are basically sitting a perch to one of the busiest streets in San Francisco, but we're isolated, sort of. We have a little bit of a skylight here.
Yeah, and a much farther distance from the actual road than we were in our previous.
That's true. We go from one busy street to another, but at least we have our little alcove here. We don't have a name for it yet. I guess the WCB Studios, for that matter. I don't know.
That name might be already taken by some place in the East really? Coast,
West Coast bias, East Coast bias.
Any call letters that start with W is for east of the Mississippi.
WKRP.
Yeah, in Cincinnati, sure.
I have I have Sonny Gray on my team this year, although he's not going to start the season. But let's, you know, we got a lot to get into. We got Giants and Dodgers. We got all West Coast. We got everybody, right? We got balls that are juiced. We got NFTs. We got new rules. We got all kinds of stuff. Let's just say a little happy birthday to Phil Niekro today. Mr. 95.9 WAR. And we're going to get a little bit into that later as well.
All right.
He would have been 82 today. He died the day after Christmas last year, Boxing Day, 2020. He's 318 wins for a knuckleballer. It's by far the most of any knuckleballer. And he's, I think, 16th all-time in baseball wins. Now, wins aren't, you know, don't have the luster that they used to because we know more about the game. But it's still still a benchmark to measure players.
And sure. And what thing about Niekro is that knuckleball is extraordinarily difficult to throw. It's extraordinarily difficult to catch, and it's also extraordinarily difficult to hit. And for him to have such success with it for over such a long period of time is truly, truly remarkable. And you know, there's been some recent videos, some of the things that I did happen across baseball related this past off season was just a really cool slow motion shot of a knuckleball floating through the air with absolutely zero spin on it. It was quite a very cool little piece of video. It is something that doesn't translate well, of course, to this audio medium, but I do encourage you to go and look for it. I'm sure it's on YouTube somewhere.
It'll be interesting to see maybe a revolution. I mean, you see guys who are waning in their career attempt to start throwing the knuckleball to give a little longevity to their career. But in this world of RPMs and, you know, revolutions per minute on the ball being almost the most important thing when talking about break and rise for curveballs and fastballs, respectively, it might be interesting to see a guy come up and only work on that. It doesn't seem like anybody could really teach that, though, at the lower levels, like high school level, you know, college even. You might have to get lucky with a Tony Gwynn type pitching coach at like a state school like he used to teach
Well, sure. I mean, there's one thing to be able to teach the grip of it, and there's then a whole other way of actually being able to execute. And I think the one factor that all of the great knuckleballers in history has had in common is they've had really, really big hands. To be able to really hold the ball with their first knuckle rather than their fingertips. So be able to fully grip the ball with your front fingers bent all the way in to be able to then push the ball out from your grip, you need to have very long fingers to be able to do it. So I think there's a physical aspect to the pitch that just cannot be taught.
And the physical aspect, right, exactly. And, yeah. You know, you may be able to fortify your nails with a little collagen powder in your daily smoothie, and maybe the future will have that. Because I remember that's what R.A. Dickey always had problems with. But he threw a hard knuckleball, and his did rotate a bit.
Right, and a lot of knuckleballs do have a slight rotation. Like, a slow knuckleball may two revolutions on its way to the plate. Which causes the airflow around the ball to behave differently than if our friend Trevor Bauer were to throw one of his curveballs, you know, spinning with a much higher spin rate.
About 2,500, 2,400, 2,600.
That ball has been studied in wind tunnels a lot more than a knuckleball with, and has a far more predictable movement. So if you can see, like Ted Williams could see the ball spinning, and then you have a better chance of predicting where that ball is going to end up. But when that ball is floating, has no spin or very little spin, it becomes much harder to predict of where it's going to be. So you could swing in one area and the ball ends up in an entirely thing. This is also why a knuckleball is so hard to catch, because you set up for it to be low and outside and ends up being high and kind of inside. And, it's just no way to tell because the ball's not spinning. It's subject to all sorts of forces that normally thrown ball would not be.
Right, it's not as predictable. Go watch Knuckleball. I think that's what the movie's called. It's a documentary. It came out a few years ago. Phil Negro's in that. I think Charlie Huff, maybe. Definitely R.A. Dickey. Great, great documentary. Go check that out. But speaking of Trevor Bauer, MLB, and he's been on MLB's case for a long time. Well, among other things. Many things. And honestly, you know, he used to bug me. And I haven't come around to him just because he's wearing blue.
Oh, you haven't?
No. But I was excited, and maybe more so than the rest of my Dodger peers or cohorts or fans who are a bit skeptical. He would always talk about how if he put pine tar on his fingers or some sort of this sticky situation stuff that Garrett Cole talks about, he could increase his RPMs by like 200 to 400, which is insane. He never did. Supposedly, he talked about this, lamented it, and, you know, said that 99% of guys do it. And then obviously last year we see him get a few more ticks up on that RPM and he's lights out and virtually unhittable. So my first thought was, okay, maybe he's just said, screw it. I'm just going to do it because everybody else is doing it. And I'm going to show you guys how much better you can be. And if that's the case, then 100% it was like night and day. He's Trevor Bauer, a good two starter to Trevor Bauer, the ace, the Cy Young, literally, award winner, I should say.
Yeah, we'll talk. Imagine we'll talk
but
about.
But MLB is set to enforce this season new policies to limit the use of foreign substances on baseballs.
Right. Well, this has been an ongoing issue with baseballs dating all the way back to the infamous spitball. Pitchers have always been trying to alter the ball out of their hands so that, well, it flies differently.
Right.
Like we're talking different spin rates, different, you know, weights, they all affect the flight of the ball. So this is not surprising, and it's always been sort of a cat and mouse game, and this is the latest.
Well, and you know, it's kind of strange because it's always been illegal. You've never been able to do this. So right. They sent a memo out to all 30 teams, including information about inspecting balls taken out of play, analyzing spin rate data, and closely monitoring dugouts and clubhouses. You know, I mean, Trevor Bauer applauded this. He's like, yeah, finally. But at the same time, none of this is real. Like, how are they going to enforce any of this? You know, it says the league will examine whether a pitcher's spin rate significantly improves from his normal spin rate, quote unquote. According to ESPN, MLB will also test balls taken out of play, both randomly and if officials have reason to suspect wrongdoing. The baseballs will be sent to a third-party lab, and they'll be tracked and, you know, and tracked back to the pitcher who used them. But, I mean, who's to say that it didn't come off of the bat? You know, you can have pine tar all the way up your bat to a certain point, you know, the width of home plate.
Right, well, I imagine with the quality of video these days, be able to see.
It could already be on the catcher's glove. I mean, it could be on anything.
Yeah, it's certainly impossible. Can. It'll be hard to detect, I think, exactly the source of pine tar, given the range of use of that particular substance. But I think that, you know, I will probably end up circling back to this at some point in our discussion here today, because it has, you know, to do, you know, part of enforcing this rule, don't alter the baseball. I mean, the whole point of these substances, according to Trevor Bauer, is to get a better feel and a better grip on the ball.
Well, and so, and then thereby increasing RPMs, because it's all about RPMs.
Right, it's all about RPMs. It's all about spin rate. So here's the thing. So there's reports about the new ball in 2021 that both there's a couple. I guess it was Bauer. It was Blake Snell and Garrett Cole. Both said that the new ball feels different, feels better, feels like they have a better grip on the ball, better feel for those threads. So, and both of those particular pitchers had extraordinarily good springs, as did Trevor Bauer. And so maybe part of the strategy and the altering of the new ball is to, yes, we're going to say it is illegal to alter the ball or to have anything, any foreign substance on your hands other than the already approved stuff like rosin on the ball.
So you're saying that they're purposely putting a dead ball out there to mitigate to 400 RPMs fewer.
They say it's a dead ball, but that's why I said we're going to ultimately circle back to this. Lately. But right. But they loosened the.
The seams are a bit raised. That's what Snell said. Snell said that he could feel a noticeable difference.
By making the ball easier to grip, the incentive for using these foreign substances also will drop.
Or they'll be that much better if they use them.
That remains to be seen. But if you feel like you needed the substance to get a good grip on the ball, and now the new ball, you can grip well enough without the substance. Do you really need to use the substance?
Yes. And I'll tell you why. Because 99% of these guys, let's just say all of them, use something. Now, Garrett Cole is famous for using the Angels... The Angels equipment manager has some sticky solution that he makes.
He's a Yankee now, though.
It's a prep, right? But he still, there's the text from him saying when he's going, he's like, "Hey, I'm going to be in Anaheim. You could help me with that sticky situation." Winky emoji, you know. He probably bottles it and sells it to all these guys. But anyway, why I don't think that's going to work is because these guys have been using this their entire careers, And they're not going to gamble on, oh, yeah, hopefully the balls are different this year. They're going to continue to do what they do. They're getting paid tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases. And if you are right and they do raise the laces, it's going to be that much better for them to continue to do what they do. Now, the weird thing about looking back and analyzing past spin rate compared to now is that all the guys would have had always used this. So their spin rates would be the same whether or not they're using the substance this year or last year. Are you going to dock a guy if his spin rate goes down dramatically? Like, hey, you were cheating the last 4 years and now you're actually honest and now we're going to punish you? It's so stupid. The memo and the new policy is so full of holes and is so unregulatable that it's almost silly. It's really just maybe they're just throwing that out there to cover their asses to say some fans might get angry. But at the same time, when batters are asked, they say that they prefer the pitchers to have something on their fingers if it gives them more control so they don't get hit in the neck.
Well, you know? Yeah, there's certainly that aspect to it that, you know, if the pitcher doesn't know where it's going to go,
right,
you know, it goes back behind and hits the bull at the backstop.
Yeah, that's no fun at the office.
No,
at the plate.
It really isn't. So I mean, I understand that, but I think it'll be interesting to see and whether or not the ball changes significantly in terms of home run rate and whiff rate remains to be
seen.
Well,
and that's another thing that I was always under the impression that, and based on, you know, year after year spring training people talking about this, that the balls they use in spring training are just old balls they use from the previous season. So that wouldn't really fly with Cole or Snell saying that they could feel the ball differently, unless it's like psychosomatic thing and they heard rumors and now they think that it's true. Or they are using these balls this year, but that kind of flies in the convention of using past year's balls.
So in my research these past few days, I found a couple really great articles. But one of them said that, yes, that is absolutely true. That during spring training, they get rid of the backstop of balls from the last season. And then they slowly start, as that sort of starts to dwindle, they start to bring in the new balls and everything. So it can relate where the beginning of spring training, they're using the balls from the previous year. And then towards the end, they're using more and more of the balls for the new year. And this article cited a study that was done analyzing something like 46,000 pitches over this past spring training, and with spin rates and specifically measuring coefficients of drag that is measurable by the camera on the ball. How are they actually able to do that? Well,
launch
the StatCast,
angle.
And yeah, it is part of the StatCast thing, but they were able to see the new ball has a higher drag coefficient, meaning that it creates more drag as it's flying through the air than the previous year's ball, correlated by the StatCast analysis that the balls at the beginning being used at the beginning of the spring training season were different than the balls used at the end of spring training.
So they're peppering in new balls just
so and gradually bringing in as the old stock diminishes, as they get hit out of play, pulled out of play because of scuffs and what, you know, they hit the dirt, whatever, and the ball's no longer usable. So those balls start to disappear and then they bring in the new stuff. So they have been using it and they have noticed a difference in spin rate and drag coefficient between the two balls already. It was a very interesting study.
Your ideas are intriguing to me and I wish to subscribe to your newsletter.
Now, the only reason why I might not believe that they would do this, that is, put dead balls in. You know, I'm using the term dead ball extremely lightly, but is because they don't want to see more strikeouts. They don't want to see fewer outs. I mean, more outs. They don't want to see fewer runs. That is MLB, right? I mean, everything they've done in terms of new rules, you know, three-pitcher minimum, mound visit limits, you know, all these things go toward making more runs, to making more action. And that actually reminds me of how this year in Double A, they're banning the shift. They're going to try this experiment in Double A where no longer can you have a fifth or a fourth outfielder. No longer can an infielder play anywhere beyond the infield dirt. No third baseman behind second base and so on. So they're going to institute this because they want to see, you know, I mean, a lot of people are clamoring for this. I don't know why. I mean, I get it. I get why people, because it's, hate it, because it's really frustrating to see a guy hit a ball through the you know, 2 and 3 hole or 3 and 4 hole and get out, you know, from I don't even know if you can call it a fourth outfielder or a super deep infielder, because they don't want to see all these outs. So why would they have a ball that has higher laces and a higher drag coefficient? It just sort of flies in the face of everything that they've been doing.
Well, I think the biggest complaint that people have been talking about is that it's been more and more, especially in the last 5-6 years, been all or nothing. It's been all strikeouts or home runs, and very little
or three true outcome: walk, strikeout, home run. Yeah,
right. And that in a lot of people's minds makes for somewhat more of a boring game. The game is called baseball, not home run ball. Home run is a big part of the game, and don't get me wrong, chicks dig the long ball, but when it's a home run or a strikeout, I want to see people run the bases. I want to see base hits. I want to see. I get. And the analysis of the new ball and what they've done to change it, it's very much arguable that it is at all dead ball. They did things to tighten the acceptable tolerances for the ball, especially with related to the bounciness of the baseball.
What do you mean? Making it? Are you talking about making it tighter to make it bounce farther? But then they're also raising the.
Well, no, they're trying to make it less bouncy.
So total dead.
So that it doesn't travel as far.
How do you rationalize all this? That would be possible, well, also they're considering banning the shift. How do those two things coexist in the same world?
Well, right now they don't.
But we do know that Double A is doing this.
But the Double A is not the major leagues. It's a test.
But
bed,
they
perhaps.
Started the mound visit restriction in Double A. They started.
No,
you know,
I get
everything.
What you're saying.
Every new rule that gets implemented.
I get what you're saying, and I think it's part of baseball getting in its own way and overthinking some things.
I agree
that what is needed to end this extreme shifting is a shift in strategy rather than than a shift in any sort of rules banning a strategic play.
Exactly. Let the manager do his job.
But as far as the ball is concerned, and existing in that same world as banning the shift, they're trying to find a ball that is that's a more fair ball that isn't necessarily, it's comfortable for the pitchers to throw and throw well. At the same time, being able to be, when it hits hard, the batter gets rewarded.
You're talking about perfect world scenarios, and I don't know how they haven't figured this out by now.
Well, no, and you know, it's,
you know what? I got it. You heard it here first. Raise the laces, tighten the core. Done. Everybody's happy. All right. Now, okay, I want to move on from that because I want to hear your opinion on this, on the AA banning the shift. You know, I have close friends that are huge baseball nerds that, you know, and this might have been sort of a October fever and a bit of overzealousness, but like during those games, during, you know, I think it was like NLCS, Braves were shifting on the Dodgers a lot, and then one of my friends is like, he just texts, you know, in all caps, ban the shift, you know. And this is somebody whose opinion I respect, and I don't know if he was serious, but when you watch these games, it is very frustrating. I understand that, but the problem is, it's not the game that's wrong; it's the guy's approach at the plate. Now, here's some data though, because it does make a lot of sense. Since 2018, lefties are batting .236 when at least one infielder was in shallow right field. With no shift, lefties hit .263. I mean, that's almost a 30-point swing. Okay, so, but, you know, why a rule in the first place? You know, is it that team analytics have just gotten too good that they're making the game boring? Because obviously, if I'm a coach and I see that, I'm going to think, okay, well, let's just throw a guy into shallow right field and let's cut that 30 points down. You know, sometimes he might go the other way, but that's the thing, you know, because I stand firmly on the idea that if the opposing team is going to give you a third of the infield wide open, that you got to take it. Yeah. Right? I mean, hit them where they ain't. Everybody knows that. Yet, it seems very few are doing this. You know, in the simple answer to the shift, don't ban coaching techniques. Train players to be better. Is that crazy? I mean, it's crazy to think that only 24.4% of all batted balls were hit to the opposite field last season, given that shifts have never been more prevalent. Right? So guys are hitting it less opposite, whilst shifts are more prevalent than they've ever been. And it's actually the lowest percentage of oppo batted balls in history. In history. So, yeah. You know, they're not teaching this. Because like you said, this is all sort of they're all about the slug, right? They're all about hit the ball hard, hit the ball high. That's almost all they care about. You know, and you see guys, even in the postseason, have the whole left side of the infield open. And they're still swinging hard. Now, you know, part of this may be, and this is kind of interesting that I was sort of looking into, and it kind of makes sense, but fastballs are down. Fastballs continue to go down by percentage of pitches thrown every year. I think only 50.5% of all pitches thrown last year were fastballs, and only about 58.4% of fastballs were thrown in quote-unquote hitters' counts, down from 68% in 2010. So, it makes sense. If guys are getting something soft to hit, lefties that is, they're gonna pull it because they're out in front of it. So, I mean, that has something to do with it, I guess. But the bottom line is, hit them where they ain't. You know, don't make new rules. Don't let the managers off the hook, you know?
I totally agree. When I was learning how to play the game, I was always taught that you don't worry about hitting a home run. Just worry about making nice, solid contact.
Right.
If you hit a line drive every time that you make contact, you are going to get far more hits than you would if you try to hit a home run or try to hit a ground ball. You try to hit line drives. Try to get that nice, solid contact with a good swing on the ball. And then, as I got a little bit more advanced, my baseball career, such as it was, coach taught, you know, a basic hip drill that would allow you to keep your normal swing, but just by shifting your weight around with your hips, you could push a ball out to the opposite field or pull a ball. Otherwise hit balls up the middle. And it was really interesting to be able to do it. And I really don't understand how all of these really good professional hitters Don't do that. You open up your stance a little bit and you have your regular swing and you'll hit the ball more to the opposite field without having to change your actual swing.
Exactly.
Just your balance. And so
without having to get better, so to speak.
Right. Without it's not even getting better. It's something that
well, being forced to hit the other way is going to make you a better hitter. It's going to make you think differently.
It is. But I mean, and you don't even have to do it except for maybe with that two strike scenario. You know, you take your first pitches, you try to, you know, pull it over the wall, and then you got, you know, a 2-2 count, and you open up your stance a little bit and get your pitch and hit a nice little
right.
double and
nobody's shifting
into right.
On, nobody's shifting on Ichiro. They're not doing it because they know he's going to hit it. He's going to get a hit.
Ichiro's the perfect example. He could control where he hit the ball so effectively that everyone stayed in the normal position, so the entire field was covered because there's no way. But someone like Barry Bonds is the exact opposite. More often than not.
Well, but Barry, okay, if you're Barry, fine. Just go swing for the fences.
Well,
right.
And
most
and
guys
so
aren't
maybe
Barry.
And people were shifting on Barry before shifting was a thing.
Well, people were shifting on Ted Williams before
right.
shifting was a thing.
And for years and years, the shift was called the Ted Williams shift.
Right.
Why? Because he mostly a thing. But Ted Williams, when they did that, could also poke one the other way
exactly.
for a double, and you know.
But he wouldn't. Though. But he wouldn't. He as almost like as a rule, right? He's like, no, I'm not going to give. And so maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's just a bit of bravado. Maybe it's a bit of, no, you know, screw you. Oh, you want to shift on me? All right, here I'm going to hit a 98. You know, off the bat, come right back at you. Try to catch this.
Right, and then the whole hit them where they ain't. Well, I mean, it was Babe Ruth who said, "Oh, I hit them where they ain't. They ate them over the fence, so that's where I hit them."
That's the berry tree. Yeah, yeah. All right. So yeah, baby. You know what? I guess nobody's to blame. It's all just a bit of
it's.
Well, and now if they're starting this at double A, then these guys have zero reason to go opposite. You know, so if this never makes it to MLB, but they keep it in the minors, who's that going to benefit? It's not going to benefit anybody.
Well, it's not going to benefit anyone, and I think this rule is not a good idea. I think it'll do nothing but hurt the game, hurt the players that are coming up, and will stymie any shift in overall baseball strategy. And the game will start to stagnate that in a way that it has not stagnated in its 120 some odd year history. 100 and almost 40 now. And so I think it's not a good idea. And I imagine as the season progresses, we'll probably talk more and more about the fact that the collective bargaining agreement is set to expire at the end of this season. And so we should, you know, there'll be lots of discussions about rule changes, enforcement, and money distribution.
Do you think Universal
in
DH
our near future
is in the cards?
I think that it is a distinct possibility.
This is madness.
It is, but
I think you're not. I think you're right.
Your manager is one of the ones who is for it.
Yeah, all the players are for it.
You
That's
know,
what it seems
I
like.
I think I was Bud Black had a really good take on it. I saw he answered the question. He thinks that Universal DH is fine. But then the DH position is then eliminated once the starting pitcher is removed from the game.
Interesting.
So that this
oh,
would
wow.
this would discourage the use of an opener,
huh?
And it would still then allow for the traditional National League style of play.
Now, but that would be
in the late innings
baseball. So that'd be American League also, right?
Right. So
this is interesting.
So I really liked that, and I hope that that gains a little bit of traction as a possibility, because it would be a good compromise between the DH proponents and the non-DH proponents. It's a little bit of both. Hey,
why is this the first that I'm hearing about this?
I don't know. What articles are you reading?
Yum 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 yum.
That's not bad, man. That's not bad, because I've been trying to just come to terms with the fact that we're probably gonna have it, and the fact that the players all seem to want it, you know. And me as a baseball fan, I loathe it. I despise it. There's nothing more egregious to me that the American League still has it. But as a fantasy player, I kind of like it, because you know, I didn't draft Zach Gallen, but I know a lot of guys did, and Zach Gallen obviously has the little hairline fracture in his forearm from not even taking live at bats, but by standing in the hitter's box of a pitching machine, he somehow splintered his arm. And
is that an ignoble candidate?
We have a few others. Because, you know, it's just, and Trevor Bauer too, you know, same thing. He has a weekly vlog or bi-weekly, I don't know. And they showed him getting his first bats, the Trevor Bauer bats, and he was taking out bats, and he hates it. He hates batting. He admits it outright. He says every time he takes a swing, he feels like his arm's going to fall off. His elbow hurts. I hear that, and it freaks me out, man. And obviously, as a fantasy owner, it really freaks me out. Oh, as a real world watcher, I just think, suck it up. You know, that's the game. You never should have had all those sweet, sweet years when you didn't have to bat in the AL.
Right.
But I might be willing to meet halfway if this is universal. Once the starter comes out.
Hashtag Bud Black's idea.
So then, wow, this is really interesting. I wasn't prepared for this. I appreciate this. Let us know what you think. baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com. I can't argue with it, because you're right. It is a concession meets halfway. You know, I think we have a seventh inning stretch, so we're going to pivot to this week's
Ignoble of the Week.
Oh.
No, we do have a few candidates.
We do.
I'm not going to give it to Zach Gallen, but my candidate is MLB.tv, of course. And this is a running theme due to their blackout restrictions in-market games. Shame on you, MLB. How dare you? How do you sleep at night? I really don't know. It's really sad. The Dodgers are actually playing the A's in Oakland this week. I'm not going to be able to watch that game. You know, it's obviously Dodgers Giants are always entertaining to watch. Can't watch those. But we'll keep checking back with this. This isn't going to get the award. I believe you have the award winner.
Yeah, I found a far more ignoble award.
More than this?
Recipient. Well, yeah.
If it better involve murder, because otherwise I'm going to be upset.
Not directly, but I imagine there probably is somewhere on the line. There was probably some murder, but
really?
It's hard to tell. Well, you know, it's always hard to tell with when Mexican cartels are involved.
Uh-oh.
But a 25-year-old Chicago Cubs pitching prospect.
Oh yeah.
By the name of Jesus Camargo. Was driving through Colorado, speeding and drifting through lanes with two passengers in his car, was pulled over by Colorado State Police. And after giving permission to search his car, a canine unit alerted the police to the presence of drugs. And what was found was inside the Chicago Cubs equipment bag, 21 pounds of methamphetamine, in addition to 1.2 pounds of oxycodone.
Well, I know who I'm drafting when he gets up to the big leagues.
If so, I guess he's currently standing trial, and yeah. So, folks, if you're going to be a drug mule for the Mexican cartel, try to break only one law at a time and drive normally. And
a lot of lessons here. A lot of lessons
here. And probably don't stash that bag in your team issued, you know, equipment bag, because that would then reflect poorly on your employer. So yes, instead of being in spring training and in the minor leagues,
if you're going to be carrying pounds of any illegal substance, stay in your lane.
Well, that's exactly right.
Use your blinkers.
Only break one law at a time. One law at a time.
Not that I'm condoning any of this. And, you know, let's just, we don't know if it's Mexican cartel, so, you know, it could be anybody. So I don't want to denigrate any.
The article that I read did cite that he was paid $500 to take this package from his hometown in Mexico.
And this is why we need to pay minor leaguers. Pay minor leaguers. Are you listening to this?
$500, apparently, Jeez. He was paid.
For you. Now, Pete Alonso might have a slight remedy, and he's kind of trying to help mitigate the poverty and impoverished minor league players, as he was a minor league player for many years, and he rode the bus, and he was on those 12-hour rides, and, you know, he was quoted as saying, if you're not on the 40-man roster, or you're just a regular minor leaguer without any big league team, you're making around $2.85 an hour. When it comes down to brass tacks.
And no tips like you would be making that at a restaurant.
And if... So, you know what? Actually, $500 seems like pretty good when you're making $2.85 an hour. You know,
absolutely.
Can't blame him. Explain to me what's happening with Pete Alonso, because he is creating... I don't think it's the first MLB NFT, because I think Taiwan Walker created the first NFT for baseball. Pete Alonso is the first
wait,
to
back up.
Auction his NFT to help minor league baseball players.
Back up here for a minute. What is an NFT?
Now, we are all here at West Coast Bias on the, let's say, the latter half of middle age.
No, and, I wouldn't even say no. Well, don't even go there. Well, I did have six pieces
of bacon for breakfast this morning, and I am drinking a beer. But
we should say more accurately, we are above the average age of the Silicon Valley tycoons that live in this area, and we are not in the tech world at all.
Correct.
I think that is a far more way of stating our particular ignorance in this particular subject.
We are technologically inept.
Well, yes.
Although we are coming to you right now, so
we're not totally inept. We're just behind the times technologically.
Right.
We're not hip to the new lingos and the new ways to invest and spend monies.
Correct. Okay. So NFT, non-fungible token. Blockchain technology.
It is
crypto.
It is very much connected to and part of cryptocurrency, blockchain.
Weird, wild stuff.
Most of them are part of the Ethereum blockchain. So if you're at all familiar with blockchains, cryptocurrencies, such as Bitcoin, Ethereum, there's a few more of them out there. Congratulations. You're ahead of the game and probably already understand this stuff better than, well, us here at West Coast Bias Baseball Podcast.
I think that was correct.
But in my research and attempt to understand exactly what this is and unpacking the whole thing, you know, it is an NFT. It is anything digital that is unique and cannot be replaced by something else.
Okay, describing the show. Okay,
that is what an NFT. And yes, and this show, technically, we could sell each one of these episodes as an NFT. should we want to. It is certainly a viable option. I don't know. Don't worry, fair listeners. It probably won't happen.
And by the way, we've had options and offers for advertising. I don't want those. I don't want to have commercials on this show. I know you guys don't. And I don't like listening to a podcast where halfway through or 10 times in the middle, they go to commercial.
Continue. Or start asking for like Patreon donations.
No, that's like fine. Please hit our Patreon and our PayPal button on Podomatic. Please hit that if you are inclined. And we have had some very, very loyal and incredibly generous listeners do that because we do have costs here.
Fantastic. Well, but I'm not hearing about this thing, but thank you for those who have done.
We discussed it in the past. Yes, continue.
So it's extra inflow in this blockchain that makes them work differently than a digital coin.
Top shot in NBA is a very popular example.
It is, and it's also very big in the digital art world. So that that GIF that you absolutely love, it had to have originated somewhere.
Right.
A lot of these things are put up as an NFT, so people can buy them and use them, and the creator gets some benefit from the work other than like seeing it everywhere, especially if it becomes popular. It basically allows a chain of evidence to keep track of where digital content was created and who has owned it and used it since its creation.
Right, like a history of provenance, like in fine art or something like that.
Exactly. And a lot of the examples I found of how they work was taken directly from the art world. Like any schmo could own a Monet print, but only one.
Or a Edward Hopper print.
Or an Edward Hopper right here in this studio. But only one person could own the original of that particular Monet or Edward Hopper or Picasso. You know, there's only one original, and only one person can own that as a time. But prints can be made, copies can be made, and those can be sold and hang on anybody's wall.
So yeah, these are digital coupons or video clips, as we see in Top Shot. I'm not exactly sure what Pete Alonso's is. It came out on Tuesday, I believe, and he's donating all those to charity.
Right.
You know, it is really interesting. It still kind of goes over my head, but it's basically just proof of ownership of a digital product such as
that is unique and cannot be replaced. So like in the world of trading cards, if I were to trade you my
Buster Posey World Series MVP
Buster Posey card for your 1929 Hornace Wagner, we both end up with something completely different than what we had. This is an example of a non-fungible token. I'm not trading you a Buster Posey card for a Buster Posey card. You know, it's something completely different and totally unique. Bitcoin. I would trade you a Bitcoin for a Bitcoin. We both still have a Bitcoin, but if I trade you this digital Pete Alonso for a Bitcoin, we now have something completely different. And this was a non-fungible transaction. Right. And that's the basic bones of what this is. So it's also another way to sort of copyright digital art. It lets an individual retain ownership of the work, including copyright and reproduction rights. There's features where a digital artist or an originator of the, in this case, Pete Alonso, his trading card, can be set up in a fact that every time that this card, digital card, is traded, changes hands, sold, Pete Alonso gets a small percentage.
Is that
of,
how it works?
Of that.
I didn't think that's how it works.
In the article
you're,
that
like,
I
read. That's,
in
you're the article, describing like royalties.
In the article that I found, this is what it talked about. And it did sound very much like royalties, and that is kind of the point.
I thought that was the
because,
opposite of the point,
though. Well, but if it's, you know, I mean, digital media can be, can't even...
Well, okay, so like Picasso goes on sale at Christie's, the Picasso estate doesn't get any of that. They got whatever they sold it for originally, right? So the Van Gogh estate doesn't get anything from future sales. It gets whatever that one sale, right? I mean, that's... We're not talking about like licensing music here. We're talking about like a one-off digital token, right? Am I missing?
Well, yes, but because it's part of the blockchain, the record of where it originated, right, and any rights that the originator holds to it remains intact.
Oh, so there might be fine print is what you're saying.
So fine print, it allows for the content creator to benefit from future sales of their work. So that is how Pete Alonso can use this to raise money for the minor leaguers.
But I thought he could pretty much only do it once. He's going to sell it to somebody.
He's
going to
sell it to
distribute the money.
He's right. going to sell it.
He's going to auction it off. Yeah.
He's going to auction it off, whatever he gets for it. But depending on how he sets it up with the features, it's possible that any future sales of this will also come back through the train. It may be, you know, a small percentage of it, but it is possible to do, and a lot of digital artists are doing this to sell their work online, because, you know, ultimately anyone can capture a screenshot of any piece of digital work, right, and do what they want.
No,
with,
yeah,
it.
It's great. It's great for the artist, and it's great for the person buying, because they can actually say that they have an original.
Right.
But let's move on, because I'm sure everybody's brains are hurting as much as mine is right now.
Fancy. Yeah, and how fancy.
And absolutely, if you have more insight to how this works and a better way to explain what it is that we're talking about, please, you know, let us know, baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com, because we're just as curious as anyone.
Yeah.
So
now I'm going to look toward the rest of this season here. And, you know, we always do predictions. And I'm not talking about full-on predictions, who's going to win the batting title, who's going to do this and that. But I'm
looking
at...
Individual predictions.
What's that?
You're not talking about individual predictions.
Right, correct. I'm looking more... I'm looking at starting pitching, okay? Because this is a big concern with fantasy managers and also with real-world managers and front offices. It's how do you rebound from a 60-game season to a 162-game season? Now, it seems like the extra rest is probably a good thing for a lot of these guys, but the lack of rhythm, lack of... you know, continuous movement and being warmed up essentially for an entire year moving to the next, and the fact that it's literally never been done, it leaves a lot of question marks. Now, MLB set the record for starting pitchers used in a season with 367.
367.
Yeah. With all the talk of front offices saying there's going to be a lot of up and down players to mitigate exhaustion after coming off a 60-game season, could we see the first season with 400 plus starting pitchers this season? You know, that, I mean, this would equal more than 13 per team.
I mean, is this?
This is a trend that's been going up like every year.
Well, I mean, but is this taking account like the whole opener situation?
Well, yeah, of course.
So
I mean,
yeah, I think it's entirely possible that we 400 can see
plus?
Over that number.
It's insane.
I mean, it is insane. But you know, with injuries and openers and
short leashes.
Short leashes,
innings counts,
anything is possible.
Now, this also leaves up in the air sort of the dearth, let's say, of ERA qualifiers for this season. You know, I mean, last season it was only 60 innings, obviously, and I think only like five teams had more than two guys that did it. Dodgers didn't have any, which is insane. Neither did the Braves or the Rays, and they all made the postseason.
Right.
So, you know, how many starting pitchers will actually qualify for the ERA title this year? The 162 innings? Doesn't seem like that much. But, I mean, you know, it last year we saw the fewest qualifiers with 40. Before 2020, the fewest qualifiers in history was 57, set in 2018. Could we see fewer than 40 this season?
It's entirely possible. I mean, if every pitcher is going to, a starting pitcher is going to, say, start 20 games during the course of the 162 game season and only go, let's be a conservative average and say 5 innings a start. You know, quick math, that's 100 innings. So,
yeah,
that's not a lot. I mean, even if you go up to one inning and say, okay, we're all going to average a quality start and do 6 innings, that's still only 120.
Right.
That's not enough to qualify. So I think if it shows that there's only a handful of pitchers that hit this, you know, 162 inning minimum to qualify, I think these stat geeks are going to have to lower that threshold to allow a greater pool of pitchers to pick from.
Yeah, I mean, it seems crazy that guys won't be starting 30 games or 32 games.
But then on the other hand, you know,
it's entirely
on the other hand, you know, if a pitcher, you know, has an ERA sub 3, it's likely that they're going to stay in games longer because they're probably not throwing as many pitches.
It's true.
And the manager's going to want to leave them in a little bit longer as long as they're not getting hit. So I think maybe that the truly will see more of the cream at the top, and the ones that truly would and should be considered because they were able to get such a low ERA over so many more innings than the rest.
Yeah, it seems like, and this is something that you have to dig through for fantasy drafts and everything. And it's, you know, gone are the days of the 200 inning pitcher, or at least as a norm, or that you're going to have 3 or 4 guys on your rotation that are going to do that. Now, the 180 is the new 200, it seems like.
Yeah. And 200 is the new, like, 250.
Pretty much. But if we see universal DH, we'll probably see those innings go back up.
It's quite possible. It is certainly quite possible, or even a compromise therein.
But I think a lot of it this season is obviously just in regard to the unknown from last season and guys not having a whole year. But I think Glasnow was saying that he thinks it's going to be great. It's going to be even better. It's going to be the best ever because these guys aren't overused. Because even if they played all through October, it just seemed like it was June or July.
You know? Right. It wasn't, I mean, there's an argument that can be made that Clayton Kershaw did well in this playoff.
Oh, there's an argument that can be made. The all-time leader in strikeouts in postseason history. Yeah,
He did well and better overall in the playoffs than he has in the past because it wasn't at the end of a long 6-month season where maybe a little bit tired and arm gets a little bit lazy. It was like he was in the middle of the summer, in the middle of a stride while he was pitching in October.
I'm going to respectfully not acknowledge that. I would like to think otherwise. Now, speaking of the Dodgers being incredible, how are the Giants going to be this year, my friend?
I think that the Giants are going to be better than everyone expects, but they still won't make the postseason.
Really?
Yes.
It's not really a hot take, but
it's not really a hot take at all. I think they're going to turn some heads. I think they're going to make some runs, make a run at the end, and I think it'll come down to how really well that they do against the Padres in head-to-head this year. That will the lesser extent the the Rockies and the Diamondbacks. If the Giants can, you know, routinely beat the Rockies and the Diamondbacks and play around 500 against the Padres, I think that they will be in a very good position to make a run at the postseason when we come down the stretch.
Now, don't forget, we're not having 16 teams in the postseason.
We're not having 16. We're back to just 12. But I mean, I think they'll make things interesting. I think they'll turn some heads, maybe make some teams nervous.
Player you're most excited to watch?
I would say, you know, ultimately it would have to probably be Buster Posey.
Really?
Well, yeah, sure, because he's been ailing the last few seasons that he played. He's been nursing a few injuries in his legs, and he hasn't had the type of power that he had at the first part of his career. And I think, you know, he had a surgery, he recovered from the surgery, and then he took another full year off,
right?
For 2020, I think his legs are going to be healed, are going to be feeling really good, and I think we'll see something more resembling the Buster Posey of 2013, 2014 than we will the Buster Posey of 2017, 2018.
Now, how has he been doing this spring? Because I have not been paying attention.
From all accounts, he's been doing quite well. He's hit a couple home runs, and he's looking very good and feeling very comfortable behind the dish.
It might be the first season I've ever seen that he wasn't drafted on any draft that I saw. 10, 12-man leagues. He's off the table. But I'm sure he'll be picked up if he starts batting around 280.
Well, yeah, for sure. If he shows that, oh yeah, he has actually hitting the doubles like he was in the first half of his career, he's definitely be picked up in more leagues.
Well, and the, you know, Oracle is now a hitter's park,
well,
so to speak. It's swinging in that.
It appeared in 2020 definitely to be much more hitter friendly.
I think
it
was actually on the positive side of hitter friendly rather than pitchers, like the first time ever. It's obviously because they brought in the fences and lowered the walls a bit.
Right.
Now the Dodgers, on the other hand. Pecota, which is the the prediction system for Baseball Prospectus, has the Dodgers scoring 944 runs in 2021. For some perspective, this is 130 more than the Padres, almost 200 more than the Cardinals, and over 300 more than the Tigers. And Pecota is very conservative. You know, they don't just give these numbers out randomly. These are all very highly vetted and blah, blah, blah. How many NL teams have scored more than 944 runs in a season? Now, not counting the late 90s Coors. There are two Rockies teams in the 90s that have the top two. But
I would say not very many.
Well, you have to go all the way back almost 70 years ago.
70 years.
1953 Dodgers that scored 955 runs.
Wow.
But yeah, aside from the 96 Rockies and the 2000 Rockies, no team. I mean, you literally have to go back that far.
Yeah.
So the Dodgers are projected at 944. We shall see. Obviously, the Yankees, if Stanton's healthy, if Judge is healthy, that's a big if.
Well,
that's a dangerous team.
They're healthy. They need to stay healthy.
Correct. I believe we have a little seventh inning stretch here.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
It has. So sometimes we don't find anything that is so stretchable that it is worthy of mentioning. But I did find an interesting scenario. So we had a trade this offseason where Carlos Carrasco got traded to the Mets for prospects. It is my stretch that Carlos Carrasco is now a Met because of show favorite Bartolo Colon.
I don't have crickets. I don't have the crickets.
You don't have crickets? I was looking for some sort of reaction, but I just got sort of a deadpan.
There you go.
So okay,
explain this stretch.
So here it is. In 2002, Big Sexy was traded to the Expos from the Indians in a package that included Cliff Lee.
Cliff Lee.
In 2009, Cliff Lee was traded to the Phillies for a package including Carrasco. And so now in 2021, this trade to Carrasco to the Mets. Carrasco wouldn't have gone to the Mets from the Phillies. They're in the same division. So, you know, that's why, that's why we call it a stretch. So these are all connected. If Bartolo Colon would have not been traded to the Expos, Carlos Carrasco would not be a Met currently.
I got hairy legs.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, this isn't going to be the trivia question, but considering it is opening day, I thought that a brief little trivia question to preface the trivia question would be nice. Which team has the best win-loss record on opening day? Now, by the time you're hearing this, you probably can't really get a free beer out of it. Nor are you even at a bar, because they're probably not open. But save it for next year. Which team has the best win-loss record on opening day? I'm throwing it to you right now. Hot question.
The Yankees.
No.
No? Okay.
But you're close.
Okay.
You're close. Geographically.
Geographically close.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And it's hard to believe.
Could it be the Mets?
Ding, ding, ding.
Wow.
Can you believe this?
Since 1962?
I had to double check this, yeah. The Mets are 39-20 all time. That's a .661 win percentage. The Yankees, which was a close second, are 66-51-1. Obviously, a bit more sample size with a .559 winning percentage, I think. I'm not good at math. Something like that. Yeah, the Mets.
Wow.
You're going to win a lot of free drinks once the bars are open with that one, I think.
Yeah. Big thing. So, well, so since we're on the topic of trivia, I imagine way back in, what was it, November, or were we actually in October when we did the World Series
episode? The end of October, early November.
Yeah. Whenever that episode came out, we had a trivia question, and
that's for the end.
Is that the end?
No. Yeah, we're not there yet.
Well,
we're going all day, baby.
All day, huh?
It's been a while.
America, huh?
Well, we spent about 48 minutes on the NFT fiasco, and my brain still hurts, and I still don't really completely understand all that. But all
right,
save that because we do have some responses for that.
Put a pin in it. Okay.
Okay. Now we were going to start a new segment this week, but maybe we should wait for next week. Know your stat.
Let's
get that one's gonna be a while, so maybe, you know what, let's put a pin in that one as well.
All right,
to not let the eardrums bleed of our loyal fan base. But I did want to pick your brain on one thing before we get into the trivia. Is two the new three in terms of batting order?
I think I know what you're getting at, and I think in a lot of ways, yes. It is. It's been really interesting to watch the evolution, and really has only come up in the last two, maybe three seasons.
Well, I'll put it to you here, because arguably the trend started since 2013. Not okay. Widespread, but 2013 is when Mike Trout started hitting second.
Hmm.
And as Mike Trout goes, so does the rest of baseball. But I'll give you a little food for thought here. In 2020, the number two hitters across baseball crushed 332 home runs. The number three spot, 289.
Okay. Well, I think that...
seems we have a trend.
Yeah, no, we certainly do. And I think that number three spot traditionally has been the position for the strongest hitter, certainly in terms of average and on base percentage, if not also home runs. But typically your home run leader would hit fourth, the traditional cleanup spot, because if everyone gets on base, fourth batter comes up, clears the bases with one swing of the bat.
Right.
Now,
popular convention is that third place hitters come up with two outs and nobody on more than any other spot in the lineup. And so so that's why they're letting their best guys hit second, just in case. But so Joe Maddon began coaching the Angels. He moved Trout to three and sort of flying in the face of the modern popular convention. Although he conceded that, you know, this is often true for the first inning, that being, you know, the third place hitter comes up with two outs and nobody on more than any other spot in the lineup. He said that the remaining innings don't pan out that way. And even if in the first inning, there are actually more chances to hit with a runner on if you have two high OBP guys hitting before you, obviously. So he's all in on three again.
Right. Well, he's also very much an old school manager. And
No. He's a very much a new school manager.
Well, but he's, I mean, I know that he is a big believer and follower of the metrics and
right.
and the numbers, but he the way that he goes about his business on the field, I think is more like an old school way of thinking. There's the numbers that are there, but lineup construction, you know, he's very much old school and in those kind of ways. Like,
I think it's the opposite.
The first inning.
I think it's the other way around. I think everybody went to put your best guy into the two hole. That was new. That was like, well, let's look at it like that, right? They're, you know, you don't want a guy coming out with two outs because it happens a lot. But Maddon, you know, probably used that as well for a while. But now he's flipping it. He's always ahead of, like, everybody else caught up for that, which has been happening since 2013. And now he's moving back, which is ironically even sort of more advanced.
Well, it just shows that the old school way of thinking is probably the best way of thinking.
Well, yeah, I mean, and baseball. Yeah, we're
talking about 130 years plus of baseball history where lineups were done in a particular way. There's been some fluctuation here and there throughout the decades, but.
Well, and he was famous for batting his pitcher when he was with Chicago in the eighth hole.
Right.
Because he would have Chris Bryant batting in the two hole, you know, and so that way it would almost act like a three after the first time through the order.
You'd be able to turn the lineup over a lot more effective. If your nine hole hitter is more like a leadoff hitter, a pitcher comes up, gets an out, but then you have a good contact guy, two good contact guys coming up, and then Chris Bryant to, you know.
And also, Maddon has Fletcher, who's, you know, averaging over 300. He can lead off. But anyway, Baseball Reference seems to back all this up, showing that in 2019, the number two hitters had 9,128 plate appearances with men on base, and the number three hitters had 9,912. That's a 784 difference. And even in the shortened 2020 season, the number two hitters had a differential of a 159 versus, or I should say, the number three to number two. So, yeah, I mean, Maddon, once again, seems to be ahead of the curve.
Well, I remember back at the turn of this past century when there was similar discussions going on between the three and fourth place hitter and who should play. Specifically, when we're talking about the relationship of in terms of the batting order between Jeff Kent and Barry Bonds, and where they hit in the order. Should Bonds hit before Kent or vice versa? Because both help each other out.
Right.
But do you want Bonds to get that extra bat or do you want Kent to get that extra at bat? And that was certainly a local debate. I imagine it was happening in a few other places around the league as well, where you had a really good three and four place hitters. Well, you want a third place hitter is probably going to get more at bats on average than a fourth place hitter, just because of the way that, you know, the three outs works over nine innings.
So you're saying Barry hit Ford instead of three, or three instead of
Barry hit three,
right?
Lot of times, especially later, because they wanted him to have more that one more at bat per game, and Jeff Kent would be there as insurance, and this also caused the second place hitter, which I guess it was usually Rich Aurelia in those days, to not have the pressure to advance a base, steal a base, because, well, Barry Bonds found it a distraction to have a runner trying to steal the base. Plus the fact, if
won't matter if he hits it in the water.
Well, it doesn't matter if he hits in the water anyway, but also if there's someone on first, they were less likely to issue that intentional pass to Bonds.
Right.
And if that runner stole second base, then he would get the intentional walk at that point. So there was that as well. But
that makes sense.
And so it's always an interesting thought about, you know, what is the best way to construct a lineup. And this is just the latest round of intrigue and experimentation.
But, well, if you want your best guy hitting with the most guys on base, hit him three, hit him in the three hole. The numbers are there. So
yeah,
I think we can kind of settle on that now, but I bet we'll see a lot of guys in the two hole. Anyway, let's wrap it up. We're going to get into last week's trivia question. But before we do, in the future episodes, we're going to be doing a new segment called Promotion of the Week. We're talking about minor league, major league, little league, softball league, anything like that. If you guys have a unique promotion that is in your hometown or something that you heard, let us know. We want to highlight these. Seems kind of fun. Baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter at West Coast Bias BB. Send us a link. Let us know. I think that'd be cool. We're running a little late today, so we'll get into that next week.
All right.
But last week's trivia question.
Last week, which is last year's, but that notwithstanding, it was who was the only pitcher to face both Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle.
Ooh, who was the only pitcher to face both Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle? Alrighty, it's been a while, guys. We do apologize, but I do have Audrey V. in Oakland says, I've been wanting to answer a question from you guys for a while now, but this one is too hard, so just wanted to say hi. Okay. All right. Appreciate that, Audrey. Okay. Travis in Temecula says, it's got to be someone that pitched a long time. Warren Spahn? Question mark.
Warren Spahn is an interesting question.
Honestly, that's what I was thinking. Well, somebody like that.
Warren Spahn, I believe, was in the wrong league, and I don't think that he was pitching in the 1930s when Babe Ruth was playing.
You're right. He did pitch over a 26-year period, but that was from 42 to 65, albeit with a 3-year hiatus due to the war. But yeah, never pitched to both of them.
Yeah,
possibly to the Mick, but no.
Any other guesses?
Yeah, we got. Yeah, Babe was active. Yeah, okay. Mel in Vallejo says, not sure, but gonna have to go with Carl Hubble.
Carl Hubble.
Ooh, yeah.
Another great thing, but Carl Hubble, I think, was also a National League pitcher, was he not?
No.
No.
Was he? I don't know. I do have a few.
That is a good guess.
Some
but
side notes, though.
I think I'm not sure if the answer here is actually he's a Hall of Famer. So I don't know if he is necessarily like a household name,
like a
Spahn or a Hubble or anything. This is
now. A quick aside though, Carl Hubble, man, he had quite the run in the late 30s. And he would have been a fantasy monster. I was getting a little deep into his, you know, it's fantasy season. And I was just like, wow, man, to have him on your team, like in 1933. He secured 3 ERA crowns, averaging over 22 wins and nearly 300 innings between 33 and 39. That's in 1933, fantastic. He posted a 1.66 ERA, the first sub-2 ERA since the end of the dead ball era. And he threw an 18-inning shutout That's tied for the longest in history.
Oh my God.
And then followed that up 11 days later by beginning a streak of 46 straight scoreless innings. It's insane. Wow. He, of course, is probably most famous for the 1934 All-Star Game when he faced and struck out Babe Ruth, Gehrig, Jimmy Fox, Al Simmons, Joe Cronin. And one last note. In 1936, he won his last 16 decisions. Last 16 decisions he won in 36. And then started the next season winning his first 8 in 37. The 24 straight wins still remains the most in Major League history.
That's got to be a record.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's crazy. No. Okay, so no. That was a long-winded no. Okay, Franklin in San Francisco said, had to look this up because it was bothering me and you guys took too long to answer.
Sorry about that. We really did want to do another show.
Al Benton.
Yes, we have a winner, Al Benton. Absolutely. He pitched from 1934 to 1952, 2 years off due to being in the Navy in 43 and 44. And pitched for Philadelphia, Detroit, Cleveland, and Boston. And faced both Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle in his career,
He was also the only pitcher to pitch against Lou Gehrig, Ruth, DiMaggio, Mantle, and Ted Williams.
Yeah, so that's pretty fantastic.
Now, Gehrig and DiMaggio did hit a total of 5 home runs off of him. But he set a major league record in 1949 while pitching for the Cleveland Indians, a.k.a. the Cleveland Spiders, throwing 39 consecutive scoreless relief innings. That record held till 08. Brad Ziegler of the A's.
That was fantastic. Yeah.
Al Benton. Who knew?
Yeah. Well, everybody
knows.
Here knows.
Now,
so
what
that's,
do you
so
got
that's
for
a good
me
thing.
This week?
So this week, I was looking for something that would be relevant for opening day, but I really couldn't necessarily find one, but I did find one that was in fact West Coast bias, so I think that
really?
Works. Yes. So often some our discussions and trivia questions revolve around a certain pitcher that we all know. The big guy from Texas, Nolan Ryan.
Right.
Nolan Ryan in his career gave up just one walk-off home run.
Really?
Really. Who was the person to hit that home run?
Wow. That's pretty good.
Yes. So good luck to you all. Email us your answer to
baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com or at westcoastbiasbb.
Yes. I think with that, do we have anything else, or is that?
That'll
it
do
for
it.
Right now?
It's opening day. I gotta get out of here. I gotta go watch some baseball. I'm sorry. I love all of you. The Dodger games.
I have my day job to go to, but I will certainly be listening on the radio.
From San Francisco, California, I am Adam Nelson,
and I am Samuel Paul. Remember, baseball is life. The rest, just details.
Go watch some baseball.